total number of deaths by March 15th of 2021.
Okay.
Not that we're going to come back and check on this, but
no.
Welcome to the Rampant Discourse Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Essen, and I'm joined by our chief coronavirus correspondent, Andrew Riley. And that intro that you heard at the beginning of the episode, unlike most episodes, which when it comes from the episode itself, actually came from something we recorded about a year ago in March, I want to say 15th or 16th of 2020, right as coronavirus was starting to become kind of a serious issue, or at least an issue that we all took seriously. So, Andrew, you had an idea that maybe we should have a follow-up episode where we kind of revisit some of the things we talked about back then. So why don't you kick us off here?
Right. So it was March 15th, and now it's been roughly 1 year since that episode aired, and we recorded it. And obviously a lot has happened in a year. So I thought it would be insightful for us to revisit what we talked about and see what we got wrong, what we got right, but also just to see how much things have changed, because this has been a very eventful year for us, hasn't it?
Well, at least 12 months, I guess we should say. So many memes about like how 2020, you know, one star would not repurchase or something like that. The Christmas ornaments that like, you know, it's been so... Let me ask you this. This is not where I expected to go with this at all, which is why I'm stumbling over my words. But how would you rate your 2020? Would you say that it is as bad as everyone else is saying? Or let me just say that. I won't lead you in a direction.
It's an interesting way of asking the question. I think I had a better 2020 year than many, but I had a pretty bad 2020. You know, things did not go my way in a lot of regards, but I still did better than most people, I would say. So I'm on the top 50%, but it's tough to say exactly how far up I go beyond that, because I did have things happen to me in my year in 2020 that were worse than for a lot of other folks. I'll stop beating around the bush. The biggest negative that I had in 2020 is I got laid off. I don't have the job that we talked about me having, not in this episode, but I think we talked about the likelihood that or possibility that somebody might end up losing the job in the second coronavirus podcast where we brought Travis on board as well. And I recognized that that was a risk that I had that was perhaps higher than for some other folks. And it turned out to be true. I was correct in my prediction there as much as I wish that I weren't. So losing my job in 2020 is not good. And I would say that most people probably didn't lose their job in 2020, but an awful lot of people did. And so I'm in the same boat as many of them, but I'm also better off than anyone else who lost their job, probably, in that I immediately found another job, temporary job, and have been able to continue working on from a variety of different perspectives, making my life better. But 2020, for all intents and purposes, sucked. And I'd say it sucked for me less than on average, but that doesn't mean that it didn't suck. You know, even though I got out relatively unscathed in some ways.
Yeah, it's. I think I've talked about this before, but it's incredibly hard for me to talk about because I actually was going to write a Rampant Discourse article about this, about it, and I called it the Coronavirus Diaries, and it was. I just felt like it needed documenting, like, you know, my thoughts and feelings. It was kind of like half for me and half for other people's consumption. And I got to one point where I couldn't figure out how to go forward because it felt too much like, and this was not my intention at all, but it felt too much like I was bragging, to be quite honest. There's been a lot of talk about a K-shaped recovery, about how the K-shape is because people are talking about, oh, is it going to be a V-shape, a U-shape, like how is the economy and stuff going to recover? Is it going to be a sharp recovery or whatnot? And that's one thing that we got wrong from the previous episode, I should note. But the K-shape, the idea is that some people are actually doing really, really well, and some people are doing really, really poorly. For me, 2020 was not a terrible year. And I say that not even from an economic standpoint, but just from I was fortunate enough to keep my job, and I was able to work remotely for the since, you know, the March and onward. And that quality of life-wise actually was huge for me. Like not having to deal with a commute, being able to sit down and have breakfast with my kids in the morning and not feel rushed to have to go out the door, to run out the door. Yeah, being able to sit down for lunch with my kids most days, just walk out into the kitchen and having dinner, going on walks in the afternoon. I'm an introvert, so the seclusion and the social distancing didn't really take as much of a toll on me as it did a lot of other people, I feel like. I was perfectly content staying at home and playing board games with my family and catching up with some of my video games and doing other such things. And I know that and so for me, 2020 and also thankfully I didn't have anybody terribly close to me come down with COVID and suffer the consequences of it. So I don't say this at all to try and brag at all, but and I am fully aware of how it's been a really crappy year for others, but 2020 was strangely not a terrible year for me, and I feel dirty saying that, but that's just the way it is. There were some positives to it for me.
Yeah, I mean, to a certain extent, it sounds like maybe you have a little bit of survivor's guilt. You managed to get off pretty luckily, and that makes you feel unfortunate for everyone else. You're like, man, why am I the one singled out to be lucky? And you shouldn't necessarily feel guilty about it, but I'm glad that you are respectful of the fact that you are lucky in this, that there are people who are not as well off. And that's a very interesting thing that you're saying, where the lifestyle changes that you had obviously were largely good for you. You know, we continue to work at home. My new job is completely remote, so I'm working at home. I spend more time with my family. It's great not having to commute, less wear and tear on the car, less gas money. Those are all fantastic positives. And, you know, I'm very glad to have those things going on, even though they also do sometimes have negative impacts on the economy, which is something we spent a lot of time talking about in our first podcast, and I'm going to come back to it a little bit later on. But that sort of does bring me to that first question I had for us, which is, how have things changed since March 15th of last year? We were already talking about the fact that our kids weren't going to be going back to school until the end of March and perhaps later. And by and large, they didn't go back to school for the rest of that school year. And my kids, at least for this school year, have been pretty much entirely hybridized, where one of them was going to school and the other two largely were not. They were homeschooled using school materials rather than being strictly taught by the parents. So that's one of those changes. What else has changed because of the pandemic for you?
For me, other than the stuff that I already mentioned, and
yeah, sure,
and school, I guess it's the vacations. And man, I'm really gonna sound like an entitled rich jerk here, but our kids were getting to be just the age where it was a lot easier to take them on vacations, right? No diapers, no naps, stuff like that. They're old enough to sit still during plane rides and stuff like that, and we had plans. And, you know, my parents are getting up there in age. I'm becoming more aware that there is a finite amount of time that they will be able to travel with us as well. And so there have been some trips that we've always wanted to take. And those got completely pushed off into maybe this year. We don't know. We'll see how vaccinations go. But that was kind of a big change. What else? Diet a little bit. I didn't realize this until somewhat recently, but I think I'm eating healthier because before, again, rushing out the door in the morning, some days you don't get breakfast and you're like, okay, well, I guess I had to stop by McDonald's to get, you know, a sausage egg McMuffin or something like that. Or you forget to pack up lunch and I guess I got to go run out and grab fast food because, what other options are there? I'm eating a lot more home-cooked meals, which is great. Less gas and wear and tear in the car. Again, it's great. I'm sure I'll come up with more, but those are the big things I can think of right now.
But let me highlight one of the things you mentioned, because it's something we didn't talk about last time, and I think that's perhaps because even if I was thinking about it, I didn't think it was a possibility. Here we are a year later from when we were talking about the pandemic becoming a problem, and not only does the vaccine already exist, it has already been being given out in terms of millions of doses. It is astounding to me how fast this got turned around. Obviously, they were working on it, but they got FDA approval. It is highly effective, and the logistics of giving... There have been problems with logistics. Legitimate concerns about whether or not the government did the right things in terms of how they were funding it. But the fact that millions of people have already gotten the vaccine just 1 year after we were talking about this and had no concept of a vaccine even on our radar for that discussion shows how fast this can work and how important and hard the people who were on top of the vaccine were working. Previously, we've had vaccines come through in 3-4 years if things are being rushed, and we had it done in a year's time, basically. It's absolutely incredible, and kudos to everyone involved in that process. And I'm really excited because, you know, my parents got their first doses of the vaccine this month. I don't know when I'm going to get mine still, because I'm pretty far down that list, but it's fantastic news. And that means that this pandemic that is still going on, it wasn't something we were necessarily considering still being going on a year from now, although I kind of did recognize it as a remote possibility. We see an end to it because we have vaccine possibilities, and that's fantastic.
Yeah, and even more impressive than that, I'm trying to find, as you were talking, I was trying to find the exact numbers, but I heard that the vaccine was actually developed within like a week or two, or some kind of ridiculously short time frame. And the reason why it took so long to get FDA approval and everything is because you need to test it with a control group and a test group and show that it's actually effective.
Efficacious.
Yeah, efficacious. Thank you. Which is simply astounding. When you're talking about normally years for vaccines, and this one that was developed apparently within weeks. And I read an interesting article about how best to balance in a situation like this, where we're talking about tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people's lives kind of hanging in the balance with every month or two the delay. Like at some point, understanding that, you know, the whole basis of science is being able to test with a control and a test group, at what point do you be like, we really think this works and we can't prove it at all, but we should just start pushing it out now and seeing if it works? And it's at some point that has to be at least discussed. And I understand that it's a scary thing because you have no idea about side effects or if it works or anything like that. And but, you know, tell that to the thousands of people on ventilators whose 50-50 chance of surviving, about how like there's possibly, well, I guess the vaccine wouldn't necessarily help them, but you get my point, right?
It would not help them now, but it would have helped them if it had been around before.
So exactly.
The future ventilated people that would be in that situation.
Right. And so, yeah.
You got it turned around so fast that there are going to be many fewer people in that situation because of this. And that's fantastic. Human ingenuity at its best. Awesome work.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and especially since, and I'm absolutely no, that was one thing, man, I wanted to tell myself to shut up. The number of times that I qualified how much we weren't doctors in that first episode, I said it like five or six times, like, yeah, don't listen to us. We're just two bums talking on a podcast. But anyway, I'm not a doctor, but, it's a new type of vaccine too, right? It's the mRNA or whatever it is. So that's exciting too, because, science is cool. I'll just end it at that.
The potential that this has for future vaccine breakthroughs is also amazing, and maybe that wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been this particular virus in this particular fashion. It has opened the doors for a new era of vaccines that's a silver lining of the coronavirus. You know, this has been a really bad situation. A lot of people died. But there are good things that have come out of it, you know, spending more time with the kids, but also new vaccines for other diseases besides just coronavirus.
Now, another silver lining, and this is something I should have mentioned before when you were like, how has my year been different? I have been sick a lot less over the past 12 months in terms of miscellaneous diseases. I'd go a step further, my entire family. I guess one other life change is that I did have an addition to the family over the past 12 months. We had another child, and both my children had pretty severe respiratory illnesses early in their lives, where for various reasons we sometimes had to take them to the emergency room, get them some fluids. They were having trouble feeding, and it's a whole thing. And you know, kids go to daycare and they pick up germs. I just remember the first couple of months of their lives being constant mucus dripping from their noses, us having colds or whatever else. I think in 2019, I think one of my daughters got the flu twice because there were two different flu strains, and she got both of them, and I got one of them too. These 12 months, whether it's because just, you know, obsessively washing our hands, the mask wearing, or just not seeing other people, right? The kid's not going to that germ factory called the school. Like, I think a week ago, our family got a cold for like the first time, like during those 12 months. And it's like, wow, I forgot.
I haven't missed this.
Yeah, I haven't missed this, but I didn't realize how well we had it for the previous 12 months. So that's something that I hope will carry over a little bit. You know, maybe that that habit of mask wearing when you're not feeling well to kind of protect others, something that's common in Asian countries, perhaps a little bit more obsessively washing our hands, and just being a little bit more aware of, you know, when you sneeze in your hand, don't handshake somebody else, or, you know, a couple of these habits, maybe the hand sanitizer, the washing hands, whatever else. Hopefully it'll stick around a little bit and cause a noticeable drop in flu seasons to come.
I'm hopeful, but I'm also fully aware that human beings will go with the lowest resistance path. So I think we're probably going to see it pop back up as soon as we open the doors back up. But masks are something we weren't talking about either, and that's a big change because not only are people wearing masks, by and large, all the time in most cases, but those times when they aren't, it's become intensely politicized. We knew that this had the potential to be a political thing, but the masks being the political thing surprised me a little bit. In hindsight, it shouldn't have, but it from where we were in March of 2020 to where we are now, it's been a major impact. Obviously, the pandemic was going to have political impacts. It has, in my opinion, probably was the single biggest thing responsible for President Trump's not getting reelected. Remember that in December and January 2019, 2020, you and I had a lot of presidential debate discussions, and I was pretty high on the odds of Trump being reelected. I thought it was pretty strong, above 50% chance that Trump would be reelected because the Democratic pool was looking pretty weak. And Biden was a notoriously weak candidate, and it looked like he was going to win. And he did win the Democratic nomination and then won the presidency. He won the presidency, I think, in large part because Trump couldn't handle the pandemic effectively. And, you know, he has a lot to say that, you know, maybe it wasn't being portrayed properly in the media, but he also terribly mishandled this. And the masks and his refusal to be a part of that was a big part of it, I think.
So that actually opens up a lot of things that I was kind of interested in talking to you about. So let me just touch on one of them for now. I thought in listening to that previous episode that we did a remarkably good job in terms of a lot of things, and we were prescient in a lot of ways. But the one thing that did I guess there are two things, but one of the things that stood out to me was that we focused a lot on the washing your hands and not touching your face and everything out. And we just kind of glossed over the mask thing, like, and of course, wear a mask, right? And we even talked about, like, I think I mentioned the Republican burger at Red Robin or whatever it was, yep. and how politicized certain activities were becoming. But I don't think we had any indication at that point that the masks were going to become politicized. And it is interesting, and it's always disappointing when anything becomes anything non-political becomes politicized. To me, as someone who just hates how politicized everything is in our society. But if anything were to get politicized, I would have thought and would have hoped that it would be a discussion about the constitutionality of these lockdowns and whether the government or various state governors have the authority to just kind of arbitrarily shut down the majority of economic activity in their state, oftentimes without any kind of legislative input. Or input from the legislature. And we really haven't seen that much at all. There's been some protests about the lockdowns, and we were seeing perhaps a governor in California getting recalled due to maybe some of his hypocrisy around his lockdowns. But we haven't, it seems like the masks have been the focal point, which has been interesting to me. I don't understand that as much. Like, masks are relatively harmless to wear. Like, I'm as crazy libertarian as anybody else, but I don't care about wearing a mask. I'm certainly willing to wear a mask to try and help myself and others. But the lockdowns, though, those things are actively leading to deaths of thousands of small and mid-sized businesses, I think it's safe to say. And I just don't know why that's not getting more attention, and the masks have been the flashpoint. Do you have any theories?
I can go in so many different ways on this one. I'm going to try and keep myself narrow. Sorry.
No.
First, there are lawsuits ongoing about the overreach of the executive branches in terms of lockdowns. The executive is deferred to by the judiciary in a lot of ways and a lot of times for emergency situations. But the thing about emergencies is that emergencies end. And so after a couple of weeks or a couple of months, if you want to keep the lockdown going, fine. It seems like it might still make sense to do so. But at that point, these lawsuits are contending, then you need to make sure that you're getting legislature's approval and that this is going through a process that is responsible to the people that you're trying to serve and protect. And that hasn't happened. So those lawsuits are ongoing, and I think they have some legs to stand on. But you're right, they aren't in the news. They're not being talked about. And they're pretty minor lawsuits as far as these things go. They're probably going to be eventually decided by the Supreme Court. And I look forward to seeing where that goes. But it's not where people's attention is focused. The attention is focused on the lockdowns, but not about the legal response, but, you know, just stop it, you know, protest and try and make it happen that way, and about the masks. And I think it is about control. The average person on the street is not going to be able to go and make a lawsuit about the lockdown or assist in it or write an amicus curiae brief, but they can absolutely refuse to wear a mask as a symbol of personal protest or go protest and honk their car horn because it's something that is very easy for them to do. And being forced to do something themselves, you know, if the business being shut down, the business owner gets upset about that. Me being forced to put on a mask means I have to change my behavior. And when you try to force a change behavior across millions of people as opposed to across tens of thousands of people, the business owners, it's a much, much bigger ask from the government. And so the fact that a small group of people are so adamant about it and then have the support of people who are upset about the lockdowns, it turns into a bigger thing than I would have predicted, even though it, in hindsight, is something I should have been able to see.
So I'm still a little unclear as to whether you consider yourself a libertarian or not. I think we've gone both ways. I think you've objected to being called that and then immediately afterwards said it as a libertarian. So
as a libertarian leaning person, I have libertarian tendencies. Let me clarify what I mean by this
thing. Okay.
I am a small L libertarian. That means in general, I am in favor of a small federal government. I'm also, generally speaking, in favor of a small government, period. I'm close to anarchist in a lot of ways in that I think a no government is the best solution for most things. But if you have to have a government solution, I'd like it to be the smallest governmental solution possible. I believe in subsidiarity, that the smallest unit possible should handle the problem. And if that happens to be the government, fine. But by God, it better be only the government that can do it at this point. That fits well with a lot of libertarian ideas and voluntarianism. But where I fall away from a lot of libertarians is that I'm not so much on board with the political capital theories and the economics of a lot of libertarian thought, especially right libertarian thought. I'm very, very conservative, but not always conservative in the financial way that you are.
So I don't know if it's small L or big L libertarian, but there's something called the non-aggression principle, right? Where
sure.
And as long as you're not hurting another person, you should be free to do whatever it is that you want to do. So as a purely politically philosophical exercise, how do you stand as your strange, somewhat but not libertarian person on making masks required, but the government making masks required?
I don't think the government should be the one making the masks required.
Okay. What if they do?
It's probably sufficient that everywhere that you go, the private businesses are saying it's required to be on their private property. They're in their presence doing that. That's wherever people are gathering, it's almost always private. And if they're all saying you got to wear the masks here, you're probably fine. For those situations where that's not happening, you're out on a public place in the park, the government saying you got to wear the mask in the park, that's fine. I can see that. The government saying at any point when you're out in public and you're within 6 feet of someone, you've got to be wearing a mask, even if it's not public property. I feel like that's probably an overreach of government response, even if it is correct. You know, it's something that is helpful for people. Forcing it is probably too much. It's something that I wish just people would do on their own. And when they don't, isn't something that should be criminalized. And what we have seen as a result of this, we have seen people being shot, people being punched, people being assaulted for wearing a mask or not wearing a mask and trying to execute their choices in situations that shouldn't have this kind of, I don't know what the word is, vitriol about it. It's getting to something fundamental. And I knew that there were elements of this country that were on the fissure, close to a breaking point. I really, really didn't expect the masks to highlight that breaking point the way that they have.
Yeah, I mean, I personally speaking, I can understand the instinct of you can't tell me what to do, and I don't want to wear a mask, and I shouldn't have to be told to wear a mask. I actually understand that. I disagree with it, you know, and I think out of most people I know, I'm actually the most obsessive mask wearer. I like to say that I went to the beach and I was wearing my mask in the ocean. So I'm not getting it wet because I know that would be just kind of weird. But just like wading out in the water with my kids. So, and people were giving me kind of weird looks. So I'm totally on board with mask wearing, but I understand the instinct of not wanting to be told that. What I don't understand is the people, and it's hard to tell how common this is or how much it's like the media just amplifying the dozen weirdos out there who would probably be doing weird stuff anyway. But I don't understand the people who are like aggressively pushing the non-mask wearing on other people, like going up and coughing in people's faces, being like, "Oh, you want to wear a mask? How about this?" And like, that's just common courtesy not to do that. Like, you even normally, not in COVID mask wearing times, you wouldn't do that. Like, what is wrong with people? Right? It's weird.
Yeah, if I'm wearing a mask and you come up and cough on me because you think that my mask wearing is somehow infringing on your rights at that point, one, you're insane, and two, you've assaulted me. Thank you.
Yeah, it's there's been enough videos of that where I'm like, God,
that is weird. That's got to be an extreme thing, because it's not something I've certainly paid much attention to, and haven't heard about it very often. And that's not okay. That shouldn't be happening. The more common thing, the thing I do interact with in my own life, is that I have some very conservative friends and family members who are not about that mask wearing. And many of them are, look, the masks don't work. They don't do anything. I'm not going to wear them when I don't have to. If I have to wear it to go into the store, fine. I'll wear it to go into the store because that's what the store is requiring. But I'm not going to do it for any other reason. And so if I'm visiting them, which I very rarely will do because of these health concerns, but no masks on. And so I have to recognize that. And there have been times when I've had to visit with some of these people. And so, yeah, it's concerning because that increases the risk of transmission of these diseases. Although they don't think so. The masks, the virus is going to flow right through it. We talked about that in our episode. Of course the virus will fly right through the holes in the mask. These masks are not designed to prevent the virus from flowing through it. That's not how they protect you. They protect you by making sure that spittle and snot doesn't escape. Because it is the hole is too small for that to fly through. And that is the vector the virus is on. The virus is not just on the air, it's on the droplets, and the mask can catch the droplets.
Yeah, and as
a failure to understand the science of that.
Yeah, and as someone, again, with a newborn at home who sneezes a lot, like, I can tell you, like, yes, droplets go everywhere when that happens. So I'm a little disappointed with how reasonable your answer on the whole non-aggression principle mask wearing thing was. So let me try again to gin up some controversy.
I'll make sure I'll rile you up before we're done tonight.
Okay.
Because I got a couple things for sure.
Well, so you mentioned about how terrible a job Trump did with the pandemic and with the response. And I don't necessarily want to disagree, because anybody, like, at every turn, he was trying to downplay it and try to send out signals not to wear masks and just doing all sorts of awful, awful things. And yet, if you look at a lot of the metrics of the United States compared with, and this is a very difficult thing to do because every country is different with a different situation in terms of when COVID got introduced and all sorts of other things. But the United States largely, I think if you look at per capita numbers, did okay. Right. Another way to look at it is, like, outside of a handful of maybe Asian countries where mask wearing is a lot more common and where maybe they were a little bit more on top of things, most countries handled this pretty poorly. Like, this was a lot of the European countries had a lot of a worse time with it than we did. The United Kingdom, Italy, Spain, and they should have similar resources that we do. And so my question to you is, kind of putting aside the things that Trump said and a lot of the visuals of his response, how did the numbers seem to indicate the United States did okay and did just as bad as everybody else? Like, we didn't do significantly worse.
I think we got that.
Yeah, I shouldn't say okay.
The United States did just as bad as everyone else.
Yeah,
right?
We didn't do significantly worse than everybody else. And do you agree? And if so, why do you think that is? Like, why? How come, like, the much more sophisticated and science-based leaders like Justin Trudeau and Macron and Angela Merkel, How come they seem to largely have, although I think Germany did a little bit better. But anyway, how come there's not numbers indicating that they did significantly better than us?
Because, let me ask you your question, then I'll take it in a slightly direction. I think the reason why everyone did equally badly, for the most part, is that the reproductive rate of the virus, how infectious it is, was so high, that this virus was so infectious, that it, to a certain extent, didn't matter. Because no one was doing enough, except possibly China. And this is one of the things that I was going to turn back to a bit later on, because China locked their shit down tight. And I called out on our 1 year ago podcast that I said, this seems unreasonable that they're doing this well, considering that they were the epicenter of the outbreak, and we know how infectious this is. The evidence is that China did lock down very thoroughly, and because of that, had a pretty strong response. The United States could not lock down to that extent. It would have gone against everything that we stand for in terms of our politics, as a country. Even the Democrats would not have been okay with what level of lockdown China had to go to. And Italy tried to, but only after the horse had left the barn. It was too late, and they couldn't even then. And the UK similarly had the same kind of problems. No one could lock down enough to make it stop happening. And so if no one can do enough to have it stop, if no one was taking it seriously enough, then everyone's going to have fairly similar results, as long as the demographics and the healthcare systems are up to the task. And we have a fine healthcare system. It's just very, very expensive. And our demographics are healthy enough, even though we have the highest rate of obesity. And that's one of the contributing effects that could be worse for us as well. We were just as bad because we didn't lock it down hard enough, but no one did for the most part.
So that's actually a really good segue into something else that I wanted to bring up that I wasn't going to bring up now, but I might as well. Were the lockdowns worth it? Because it sounds like to me what you're saying is that variations in the intensity of the lockdowns, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but I'm just trying to interpret what you said. It didn't matter that much because the virus was the infectiousness of it was so high that, you know, locking down whatever 80% versus locking down 30% didn't make a huge difference. You kind of had to lock down 100%. And I point at some of the discrepancies we're seeing in some of the states. Like a couple weeks ago, or maybe months ago, before things blew up for Mr. Cuomo in New York, it was pretty common for the media to be praising the job that New York had done, Andrew Cuomo, and to just be running article after article about how stupid Florida was because they were leaving their beaches open and all sorts of other things. And yet, if you look at the numbers, New York's numbers are almost uniformly far worse than Florida's numbers. And if you look at California, who, again, they're on the verge of recalling their governor because of some of the very, very strict lockdown measures he's enacted and broken on his own. So that plays a role, certainly. California's numbers are largely worse than Florida's as well. And, I mean, we're talking about Florida here. That's where all the old people go to retire. You would think, if anything, Florida would have much worse numbers, all things being equal, because they have an older population who's more prone to dying from COVID. And so I'm struggling to see strong evidence that variations in the length and severity of lockdowns produce appreciable differences in fatality or spread of the disease. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Well, when we were talking about this a year ago, the terminology we were using was flattening the curve, right? The goal was, we know this is coming, we know it's going to be a little bit bad, so the goal is to prevent it from being as bad as it possibly can, and really we're going to extend the length of the badness so that the peak isn't as high. And that was the goal. And we did do that, because Italy didn't, and we saw what happened in Italy. Italy was not able to flatten the curve, and their healthcare system got overwhelmed, and they had a lot of people dying from lack of medical care, medical ventilators, etc., that could have survived otherwise, and frankly did survive in the United States in very similar situations. Now, we had advanced warning because it was already happening in Italy, and we took it more seriously. We had those lockdowns. So there is a threshold at which a lockdown has some effect, and then there's an additional threshold where it has enough of effect that it actually limits the spread of the disease. the United States was consistently in between those two thresholds. We always had lockdowns enough that we didn't overwhelm our system. We always had a flattening of the curve happening, but we never locked it down enough that we had safety in large portion because people weren't communicating the disease to each other. Inside that range, different states were different, but they were all in that same range. And importantly, they were in that range at different times as well, because one state would open up and then another state would close down because they saw their numbers in their state and they reacted to those things. And that's where our federal system was actually really excellent. Trump gets a lot of hate for how he handled it because he didn't have a strong national policy. And I'm thinking that might actually have been better if we hadn't had a national policy on this, because it meant that the governors, for all the complaints they had about it, had to make decisions locally that made the most sense for their states. And frankly, the mayors had the best control of this. So yes, Cuomo in New York, but really Bloomberg in New York City has a lot more to go on and say how he handled it was right or wrong, because it's where the disease is in high percentages. And DeSantis in Florida chose a different path, but his path was focused on making sure that those nursing homes, where the elderly were, stayed locked down, where the beaches, where the young people went, weren't. Whereas Cuomo and Bloomberg were like, okay, we got prisoners who have COVID, and we can't have them in the prison system anymore, so we're going to put the prisoners into the nursing homes, because that was what the law said they had to do. It's absolutely nuts that that's what the law said they had to do, but it's part of the reason why situations in New York were so much worse at times than they were in Florida. There's so much going on beyond just the, okay, they locked down 20% versus they locked down 50%. It's the when and the where and so many other factors as well. And they all play into, did we, generally speaking, take this seriously enough? Could we have locked it down completely for 2 or 3 weeks and eradicated it completely and not had to have had months and months of this? Or would that have had even worse effects?
So a quick fact check. I believe you are living in the past a little bit, and the mayor of New York City is no longer Bloomberg, but is de Blasio, which you should remember from...
Yes, you're right.
From our Democratic debates.
BBB de Blasio, right. No, obviously it's not Michael Bloomberg. I don't know why I said Michael Bloomberg. He was the mayor of New York a while ago.
And for a while too, right? Like, it's understandable, like, when you were mayor that long. But that's a really good point. Shoot, what was I going to say? Something about lockdowns and... I'm going to have to cut this part out, aren't I? God, what was it? It was the lockdowns. Oh, yeah, okay, right, yes. I'll go you a step further. So... you were talking about how our federal system was in some ways worked to our advantage. I will go a step further and say I have a theory that we were not well served by... So one thing I didn't quite realize when we first recorded that episode is that how New York-centric our COVID problem was at the time. It was very much centered on New York. And unfortunately, because...
It was 98% New York, basically.
Yeah, and unfortunately, because most of our media is New York-centered, it kind of gave the impression that this is like a huge nationwide problem. That's certainly the impression I got. It was like, oh my God, COVID is here. Look at all these people who are dying in New York, and like we all have to lock down. When in reality, I think... And obviously, this is all hindsight, and I don't think that... there's any reason to kind of blame the politicians for what they did. But knowing that we were facing 12 months of rolling lockdowns, I think, and knowing that people, there's a finite patience for lockdowns, right? I think one thing that we didn't take into account as a country is that, yes, you can tell people to stay home for 12 months, but they're not going to do that. They'll maybe listen to, you need to lock down for a month or two, but at some point, they're going to get tired of it, and they're going to start going out to bars.
I need to push back on this.
Okay.
Because I'm not entirely sure you're right. I mean, yes, what we saw is that people stopped paying attention to the lockdowns, but is it because we told them, you're going to need to lock down for 12 months, and they're like, no, I don't want to lock down for 12 months. I'll give you a month. No, we told them, give us 4 to 6 weeks, and this will all be better. And then in 4 to 6 weeks, it wasn't. And we said, give us 4 to 6 more weeks. It's always, we need to extend this bridge a little bit further. If we had come out at the very beginning and said, look, we're in for a rough time for a year or more while we figure this stuff out, and until the vaccine gets here, we're going to have periodic rolling lockdowns to make sure that this flattening the curve happens, because we're going to need to flatten this curve for a really long time, there would have been a lot of pushback against that. There would have been uprisings and all kinds of things, but the messaging was so poor because it was never consistent. It was always, oh, we need to do a little more. We just need to do a little more. And I think that people are too smart for that. I'm usually not giving people credit, but I think people are too smart for, you can't just string me along like that. This is not a goat rope. I am not the goat here. You tell me the facts, or I'm not going to believe you. And when Trump is out there saying, oh, this is no big deal, it's no worse than the flu, people were not believing him. And that was the problem. When you lose the credibility in leadership, that's what hurts things the most. If he had been honest and said, look, we're having a bad situation, it's here, it's going to cause problems, we're going to take care of it, though, that would have been leadership. And he then has to follow it up with action, which is, how are we going to deal with the impact? We're going to lock things down. What is that going to do to small businesses? What is that going to do to the employees of the small businesses? Here is our financial response to that. We're opening up the coffers, which we did, but he needs to say it part and parcel with this and probably do more than what he did, because we had later tremendous financial stimulus coming through, but probably should have been more for what they were asking the country to do. And if they had done that all together, I think it would have been a better response all around, and people would have believed it and said, okay, look, if you're telling me I got to sit tight for 12 months, but you're going to pay for it, I'm not happy about it, but I'll make sure my people are safe.
I think we largely agree on this in terms of, yes, the string along was terrible. The 4 to 6 weeks, 4 to 6 weeks more. I guess my argument would be that, assuming that, and again, this is all hindsight, and I don't think it's reasonable to have assumed that we could have known differently at the time, but knowing what we know now, that we were going to be unable to lock down to the extent of completely preventing the spread of this virus. And so we were looking only at locking down to flatten the curve. And that in the early stages, it was a New York-centered problem, and that we were looking at potentially 12 months of this. It didn't make sense to shut down the entire rest of the country when it was mostly a New York problem, and instead wait until it became a problem outside of that, and then do some rolling lockdowns as necessary. Because I think what happened...
Which is basically what happened.
Well, I think what... unfortunately, I think what happened is we locked down the entire country when it was a New York problem. And then by the time it became the rest of the country problem, people were kind of getting fed up with this string along that you're talking about. And we're like, no, we've been told that we need to lock down for just 4 to 6 weeks for like 3 months now. We're tired of it, and we're not going to take it seriously anymore. And it's summertime, and we're going to go to the beach in the neighboring state and spread it over there. And we're going to go to a bar and party and spread it over there. And I think that caused more problems than it was worth. I think if we had been like, let's lock down New York to flatten that curve there, and now when it pops up in Chicago or wherever, let's lock it down there, we would see maybe a little bit more of a spread, but I think we'd see a lot more people paying attention to the lockdown and obeying the lockdown, and not all this kind of disobedience that we saw. Understandably so, because again, you can't tell, like, I'm an introvert. I'm happy being locked down for 12 months. I was born for that. But I understand that my extrovert friends, they crave that social contact, and they just can't handle that. And there's some serious mental, challenges with that for a lot of people.
And not just for the extroverts, but even for introverts. We've had this lockdown in effect for so long. One of the things we had started the conversation about with this last year was, well, is this going to have any lasting impacts? Is this going to be a generational thing? And I said, yes.
I asked you when you came over, do you think this is the biggest event of our lifetimes since 9/11? And you answered almost immediately without hesitation, yes.
Yeah, it's a very big deal because the impact that it's having on our lives is on par with those kinds of life-changing moments. This is one of those moments where we are going to certainly know how it affects us for much longer than it actually does affect us.
I think that one aged pretty well.
Yeah.
This is very clearly going to be a thing that everyone who lived through will remember for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, no. I mean, my kids have started playing games based on coronavirus where, like, the virus is spreading and they have to shoot the vaccine at each other to save each other. And it's kind of a weird game that I would never have thought to play as a kid. But, that's what my kids are doing. And thankfully, my wife has been able to do a lot of work with them at home in terms of schooling. But I think there's a lot of kids who are going to be a year behind because it's asking a lot for a kid to sit behind a computer and try and learn for whatever 6 hours a day or whatever it is. and
especially young kids.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to get kids to sit still, and I'm saying that as the parent of some daughters, and I know sons are even more incapable of sitting still. You know, I know we're not supposed to talk about there's no differences between the genders, but I think anybody who has ever had kids knows that, like, the boys are a little bit hard to sit still sometimes. So, yeah.
There's going to be some lost schooling that goes along with this, and there will perhaps be lost innovation as a result of this as well. If you don't have the schooling, it's hard to innovate, in theory. I'm not too concerned about that on a personal level, because I think that the people who are most likely to be the innovators were the ones who are going to be most likely to be continuing on with the schooling or to overcome that lapse anyway, or would they be innovating in something they wouldn't have learned in school regardless. But there is probably going to be some level of innovation that doesn't happen, and that means reduced growth of GDP 20 years from now.
See, I'll go ahead and take the opposite side of this argument then. I think there are some evidence to show that a lot of companies got started during the Great Recession. And there's an argument to be made that kind of desperation kind of fuels innovation, right? Like if you were a waiter at a restaurant, or if you owned a small business that got shut down, like you need to find something else to do. And a lot of times that might be, especially with the stimulus money that got sent out, it might be like, hey, this is my opportunity. And you know, as an investor, I see some of that. There are companies like Shopify whose main goal in life is to kind of support the entrepreneur and starting up their own business. And that company has seen incredible growth. And I think we're seeing a lot of people realizing that, like, they can't, you know, they want to take their fate into their own hands. And to your point, a lot of the people who are going to be entrepreneurs and innovators and start up their own companies, I don't think that the people who necessarily learned everything in school. I think the people who probably got bad grades in school because they're either bored or they're thinking about other things, or they just learn differently. You know, Peter Thiel is very, I think he very often says, like, nobody should be going to college because it's just a waste of time. You should instead, like, take that money that you would pay for college and just, you know, try and start a business. Additionally, I do think one thing that I hope that the good that will come out of all this is I think we're going to start seeing a flight from the public school system. And I think the public school system is antiquated and desperately in need of an overhaul. And I think a lot of parents have been getting fed up, not necessarily with their teachers, because I think the teachers have been put in a very tough spot, but with the bureaucracy of the public school system, and particularly maybe the teachers' unions, who have fought tooth and nail to first get vaccination priority for their teachers, and then to still push back on having teachers teaching in school or in person, which is kind of important for a lot of two-income households where both parents had to go to work, and they haven't been able to do that because kids have been home all the time. And I think we're seeing a lot of evidence of public school enrollment in places like New York City, which has struggled to open their schools, dropping. And I would love to see years from now, or honestly, I'd love to see tomorrow, like some sort of disruptive innovation in a la, whether it's Khan Academy or it's, God, what's it called? There's the schooling where you don't pay for tuition, but you sign a contract to give a percentage of your Lambda school, or something along those lines. I'm hoping to see an acceleration of that, because I think the public school system largely does a disservice to a lot of the kids.
So school is something we didn't talk nearly enough about last year. I think we talked about it some in the second episode with Travis on as well, but how the schools closed down for months and then how they failed to open back up and how the teachers pushed back on that is a major story in this. And it was something we kind of predicted, but was bigger than I think I realized it. And I think part of that is that, frankly, you and I are guys. And even though we're parents, we got daughters of our own, you know, we are also fortunate enough to have spouses who are helping us out with this. And a lot of the house rearing of the kids and schooling of the kids ultimately falls on our wives, as it does throughout the entirety of the country. And that dramatically impacts that second income that you're talking about, that a lot of folks are relying on. And so I think that is a bigger issue that is untapped, that we're not as qualified to speak about, but is a big, big deal about what has happened in the past year.
Yeah, no, I agree that we're totally unqualified to speak of it, but I have seen numbers. And I don't know exactly how this works out, but I've seen some studies saying that, like, I don't know how they phrase it, because how I'm going to phrase it is going to sound ridiculous. But basically, that the overwhelming majority of job losses have been by females, because in a two-income household where you have kids, and the kids can suddenly no longer go to school and they have to stay home, if somebody's got to stay home, it's oftentimes the female, because of all the societal or cultural reasons, however you want to put it, whatever reason, whether it's sexism or whatever, it is how it is, and the women tend to stay home with the kids. And for considering all the talk about the glass ceiling and the gender pay gap and everything, this is almost certainly going to be a huge step back in a lot of those metrics that people find important in terms of equality or equity. I'm not sure which term is more important here. But I think we're going to see a lot of that in the past year and in the coming years.
So one of the things that has been a major theme since our last podcast on this was the increase of federal stimulus. We've had three rounds now of direct payments by the IRS. We've had three rounds of unemployment extensions. It's currently unemployment benefits are being extended to a large number of people through the end of August, after President Biden signed the law, this latest bill into law recently. The stimulus money is unprecedentedly large. It's an awful lot of money. And this latest one also increases the child tax credit, perhaps to try and offset some of this issue of the children being more expensive now in the pandemic time than they would have been otherwise. So we're seeing a lot of federal money flowing into these things. And I wonder if you're talking about the stimulus money may give somebody the incentive to say, well, now's the time for me to start this business that I've had an idea of, because I don't need to worry about the job that I can't get to anyway for a month, 2 months, 3 months. I can actually go try and take a stab at this. Doesn't this, and the fact that the child tax credit is going to be refundable and start being paid by the IRS, who's gotten very, very good at paying direct payments to bank accounts, something that they weren't supposed to be ever doing. They couldn't figure it out in March and April, but by April they were starting to get it rolled out. Now they've done it enough times, they're actually really good at it, in that Biden signed it and my stimulus is pending for my account already, right? So a matter of 2 days and it's pending. So they have figured it out how to turn this money around into the bank accounts and actually stimulate. And now they're going to do the same thing on an ongoing monthly basis for this child tax refund credit. Are we getting to a point where universal basic income, at least for children, is on the table as a permanent
thing? You stole my line. I was going to say, so how many months until we have UBI? You know, is it?
Or at least some kind of concept for that, because look, it's going to stimulate the economy. It's going to create new businesses. It's going to allow people to work from home and get that job started. And yeah, you're going to have some people who are like, yay, free $500 a month to sit at home and play video games. Great. You can't sit at home for $500 and play video games. You need something else to supplement. So it's something that gives you the freedom to try something new. Or in my case in particular, since I was laid off from my higher paying job, I'm doing a lower paying job while I find a higher paying job. And the stimulus money is tiding me over so that my family is not suffering financial hardship in the meantime. It's unemployment without having to be unemployed first, which is still better for the economy. I'm doing more for the economy now than if I was just at home looking for a job and saying, no, I can't find the job that I need right now. So I think this is pointing us in the right direction where this can be really, really helpful. And basically it sounds like maybe you agree, but maybe not. Tell me what you think.
Well, so yeah, this is a perfect example of the seen benefits and the unseen downsides, right? I mean, it's really easy to see the benefits when you start showering money on the entire country. There are a lot of impacts to that. I mean, I think it's pretty undeniable that a lot of the action in the stock market we've seen recently, or not a lot, but some of the action we've seen in the stock market is attributable to people being like, ah, stimulus check? Okay, that's YOLO some GameStop calls or whatever. Like, we've seen some crazy stuff going on in the stock market. Likewise, you know, what is it, 12 months ago, Bitcoin was around like $3,000 and now it's at $60,000, right? And that doesn't seem like a coincidence.
That doesn't sound right, but I do know, I didn't look at the numbers, but one of the things we did talk about last time was why wasn't Bitcoin higher? Mm-hmm. Well, it is now.
It is now.
It is definitely higher than it was. Yeah.
Why do you think, as our chief cryptocurrency correspondent,
this is new one for me,
why do you think Bitcoin has collapsed over the past couple of weeks?
And it's incredible. Like, I'm old enough to remember the great financial crisis and all the bailouts and the Tea Party, the rise of the Tea Party. And back then, Republicans were actually, they talked a good game about being financially responsible. They did nothing. Their actions did not match their words at all. But they at least talked about it, about being, you know, trying to balance the books and not spending tons of money that you don't have. And I think there's obviously a lot of harm that Trump did. But I think one of the biggest that's most relevant here is that he completely blew up even the lip service that Republicans were paying towards being a small government party that cared about not spending tons of money that you don't have. There is nobody talking about the price tag of this at all, as far as I can tell. I mean, sure, there's like the occasional like rinky-dink, sorry reason, libertarian, you know, news outlet that's like, hey, we should be talking about the fact that like the national debt is just exploding. Like, you thought it exploded during the great financial crisis. This is like chump change compared to that. But I think this is a little bit of a boy who cried wolf situation, where so many people were like, oh my God, this is going to cause hyperinflation and the collapse of the dollar, and how can the Federal Reserve do this? And none of that really panned out. And so I think there's this idea now that, oh, money printer go burr, we'll just like just crank it up to 11 and print as much money as we can and just shower it on people, and there's no downside. This will obviously not, you know, end poorly at all. This is just all upside. And, you know, that could probably go on for a while, but I think the end is, whether it's next year or 10 years or 20 years down the line, I think the end's just going to end badly. And that's what I think.
It could take 20 years for that to end badly, though, you're saying. In the meantime, we're stimulating the economy and getting inflation where we haven't had inflation, and actually letting people survive. So maybe kicking the can down the line 20 years. If it's a 20-year delay before it actually has negative impacts, is that actually the cause of the problem, or is there something else going on at that point?
Well, let's have a podcast in 20 years to discuss it. It's hard to say, right? Like, if...
Right. Well, it's not going to be... I don't think it's going to be an issue at that point, but simply because we're probably not going to see some of the stuff that we're talking... We're not going to see this level of stimulus occurring for 20 years straight. And to your point about the Republicans talking a good game, you know who's talking the better game about trying not to spend so much money right now? It's the Democrats, believe it or not. They're the ones who are saying, no, we can't afford to do $15 an hour. Let's get that out of here. There's too many Democrats who are in complete control who are not willing to spend more money on these stimulus packages that have prevented the progressives from getting their total wins of $15 an hour minimum wage and $2,000 stimulus checks and rolled it back to $1,400. So they're saying, well, no, we can't afford that, even though it's their party that is wanting to do it for the most part.
All I can tell you is that, listen, I know I'm the super weirdo libertarian guy who's got weird concerns about things like, you know, financial responsibility, but I am much more so now than I can remember being in the past, 2021? Yeah, in the past like 10 years, I'm much more interested in trying to find ways to hedge against a potential collapse of the dollar now, whether that's putting a tiny percent of money in Bitcoin, whether it's putting a tiny percent of money in precious metals, gold or silver, whether it's stockpiling canned goods and ammunition and bolt cutters. You mentioned bolt cutters. I remember that. So you can yep, steal it from the other people. Or whether it's, I don't know. I'm just throwing out ideas. I haven't actually taken a lot of action, but I worry because a lot of times when we see this huge explosion of the national debt and the deficit, there's at least some pushback, like, hey, listen, guys, this is a little much. Let's maybe try and not do this much. And sure, you're saying some of the Democrats are pushing back against like some of it, but not a ton. Like this is still a massive spending program.
In absolute terms, the spending here is amazing. It's a huge chunk of money, a huge chunk of the GDP. You remember that I told my story about how I said that never would the legislature approve the bailout required to get us out of the Great Recession housing crisis. Well, they're getting really, really close to those kinds of numbers with these kinds of stimulus packages, which goes to show you just how devastating these impacts are, government-issued impacts. I mean, yes, the pandemic has caused a lot of harm, but the government-issued lockdowns have been the bigger thing for the financial crisis that we're experiencing. And the reason why it's not a financial crisis is because the government has, at the same time, chucked huge amounts of money into the economy in form of this direct stimulus spending to keep the economy rolling, that we can still buy stuff from Amazon and feed our families while we are not always working and producing.
And look, I should make it pretty clear, like, in theory, because of government mandated lockdowns, this is actually one of those situations where I might be okay with the government showering money on a bunch of people, saying like, listen, we're asking a lot for the good of the country. We're asking, you know, people to sit down and sit on their butts and watch Netflix all day. So, yes, this is one of those rare instances where I think it actually would make sense to shower money on people and be like, hey, listen, just here's $5,000. Just chill out at home and don't do anything for the next, like, 6 months or whatever it is. Unfortunately, there's two things wrong with that. One is that that's not – we've already been, like, spending way more than we've been taking in for – like, since World War II. I don't know how long it's been, but, like, it's been forever. And so this is one of those things where it's the ant and the grasshopper, right? You're supposed to be saving for the rainy day, and this is the rainy day. You're supposed to have saved up money to do this, not like, hey, let's just open up 10 more credit cards to do this and you know, keep the other 10 credit cards we've maxed out our credit limit on. There has been nothing over the past 10 years that has warranted all this deficit spending. We should have been saving the money for this, so to pay for this, whatever. That is what it is. The second thing is, we're not really just giving money to people. If you look into the specifics of this bill, only a small fraction of it's actually going as direct payments to people. A lot of it's to, like,
roughly a third. Yeah, a little bit.
A lot of it is like random, like, Democratic Party wish list things, like, right? Like, here, let's shower some more money on the schools in hopes that they'll open up. Or let's, you know, like the $15 minimum wage was thrown in there, even though that doesn't really make much sense as a coronavirus relief measure. And so it's kind of like, hey, Congress is opening the pocketbooks to try and to save, help with COVID. Well, here's something that I've always been trying to get past. Let's just try and toss that in there too. And so, even if I was in theory supportive of some sort of temporary massive stimulus payment to people right now, which I think is a reasonable thing to do, this is not the right way of doing it, right? Like, if you take the cost of this bill, it's, people should be getting, like, I don't know, I've seen all sorts of different numbers thrown out there, 20,000, whatever. Like, people are not getting nearly as much money as they should be as a stimulus payment. It's just all going to, like, special interests, as usual, with Congress. And so this is the wrong way to go about it.
Well, let's take off on the financials for a bit, because we'll come back to that, I'm sure. We talked a lot about financials last time. I'm sure we're going to talk some more about financials here. But I want to talk to you about probably the most infamous moment of our last podcast, the under-over debate. So here's where that one went.
And I asked you to basically come up with a number, and you peg it, and I'll go over or under, and we'll see, you know, where we're feeling about it as a result of that.
But total number of deaths by March 15th of 2021.
Okay.
The number I'm going to pick, I'm going to set the over-under at 200,000.
I think that's a very solid over-under. I'm going to have a hard time thinking about where I'm going to go on that one. 200,000 deaths in the U.S. from COVID-19 by March 15th, 2021. I say over.
You say over. All right. But a lot over?
My numbers end up being a lot over. I'm really hoping these numbers are wrong.
So I picked the over.
I picked 200,000.
You picked 200,000.
Right, my number.
And I said it was going to be over 200,000, and we had some additional discussion about what that was going to mean and how that was going to turn out. And ultimately, it was over 200,000. We're something along 510,000, 520,000, depending on how you're reading the numbers right now, after a year, which is a lot. And it's substantially more than 200,000, which was one of the concerns that I had. But it isn't as bad as what I thought the worst case scenario could have been, which goes to show that we didn't take the Italy path, right? We did have enough to flatten that curve with our lockdowns.
Yeah, it's super weird because even though I picked 200,000 and you picked the over and the end result was over 2.5 times the number that I picked, normally you would say, God, you picked a horrible, horrible number there.
I don't think you did. Like I said at the time, I said that was a good pick in that I had to think for a little bit and went with the over because I thought that was the more likely. But I could, at the time, there were a lot of ways it could have been a lot lower than that. It could have been 10,000.
Yeah. I mean, I actually feel pretty good about that number. Like, obviously, I was way off and you won completely and totally. But I still feel like at the time, that was a decent number. I suspect, I think part of the reason why I was so off on the low end is because, again, I didn't realize at the time that what we were seeing was largely isolated to New York, right? I was looking at the numbers and I'm like, okay, assuming this is kind of a nationwide thing, and I was kind of extrapolating from there, not realizing that New York had already kind of seen the peak of it, I think, and maybe it was on the downtrend or maybe not. I can't quite remember. But the problem was most of the rest of the country hadn't even entered like the ramp up yet. And so I was kind of underestimating the fact that that, and to be quite honest, I didn't expect it to last this long. I don't know exactly what I was thinking necessarily, but I remember when people were talking about...
You believed the government.
God.
The government said it's going to be over in 4 to 6 weeks.
Well, no.
And you're like, yeah, they're lying to me. It's not going to be 4 to 6 weeks. It's going to be 6 months.
I do not want to admit to having believed the government at all. That is slander.
No, you don't.
But I do remember hearing like 12 months. I'm like, 12 months? Nah, that seems like a little bit long. Let's not be like, I guess I kind of expected by, so what is it? We determined that winter is worse, right? And summer is better for whatever reason.
Yeah.
So I kind of assumed by wintertime that we would kind of be on the downswing and hopefully be looking pretty good. I don't know why I thought that. I have no idea why. Again, not a doctor. No scientific basis for that. But I was just kind of thinking, yeah, hopefully we'll be better off then. But whatever. You won. Congratulations. I don't know. What do we bet on that? Hopefully it wasn't a, hopefully it wasn't a Bitcoin, because God, I don't want to pay that up.
I can't afford a Bitcoin.
Well, you won. You wouldn't have to afford a Bitcoin.
Oh, we're doing this retroactively? I'll take one Bitcoin.
No, one Pride Bucket is.
One Pride Bucket is, yes. So that was interesting because, you know, I do think the 200,000 was a solid peg. Obviously, it ended up being on the low side, but where we were, it was a very reasonable estimate for you to have made. And it shows that this was a very serious situation. And I think if we were to look at this going forward, we're going to see a lot more deaths. I'm not going to ask for another over-under here because it's going to go down. It's not going to be another 500,000 deaths per year. But we could easily see another 100,000 deaths per year for an extended period of time, even with the vaccines going through, because the vaccines are only 95% efficacious, which means that there's the 5% that don't get there. There will be people who are unvaccinated, and there's going to be other situations where mutations will slip through and could cause deaths. We are having good treatment rates, so I think that the fatality rate will continue to go down. But even with very low fatality rates for influenza, we have 40 to 60,000 people a year die to influenza. That's just how diseases go. And we don't worry about flu. We're going to get to the point where I think coronavirus vaccines will be a yearly or bi-yearly thing, perhaps, as we adapt to the mutations that are coming through on the strains. And we're going to see another 40 to 60 to 100,000 people die of coronavirus every year. And that will just be the new normal. But it won't be the 500,000 plus that it could have been every year if we hadn't had these kinds of situations come into play.
So I had two directions I was going to take with this. And hopefully I won't forget the second one again, like I forgot the second point from before. But first of all, we did have a bit of a discussion early on and later about how, you know, is this this generation's 9/11, basically, in terms of a kind of a life-shaping event. And I don't know if we ever talked about the loss of life really much. I think we talked about it a slight bit, but I decided I'd why not? Let's try and run some numbers. And like you said, we had a little over 500,000 coronavirus deaths. On 9/11, direct deaths from the September 11th attacks, 3,000, which is obviously horrible, but is dwarfed by the coronavirus deaths. Now, it obviously, I quickly got down a rabbit hole where I couldn't figure out where to stop, right? Because 9/11, it kind of directly leads to the Iraq War and the war in Afghanistan. And you can look at direct deaths in terms of the military conflicts there. And you can also, there's also a ton of civilian deaths. And those have been very long-running wars. And didn't you count deaths due to, like, destabilization of the reason of the region because of that? There's also, apparently, there have been 10,000 people that have been connected with 9/11 who have developed cancer as a result of that. Possibly because of whatever, asbestos in the buildings. I don't know what the actual reason is, but it sounds like we're reaching a potentially grim milestone where almost as many people have died of cancer related to 9/11 as have died in 9/11 itself. So do you count those people? And so the numbers, the bodies, unfortunately, start to rack up pretty quickly. And as you mentioned, in the typical flu season, we're seeing like, 40,000 deaths. So by most metrics, COVID has been truly awful in terms of death count. My question to you, and this is my second point, I remembered it. Do you think early on there was a lot of talk, and I don't put a lot of stock in it, but I do think it's interesting to discuss about how exactly do you count a COVID death, right? Because we know that COVID is particularly deadly to people with comorbidities, other things wrong, whether it's asthma or diabetes or obesity or just simply old age, right? And so if someone has a particularly harsh form of asthma or something like that, if someone dies with COVID, but not necessarily because of COVID, do you count that as a COVID death or not? And so, do you have any thoughts on that? Basically, do you question the COVID death count at all? Not in terms of a conspiracy kind of way, like oh the government's inflating it or anything, but like, do you think that when we're talking about 500,000 people have died because of coronavirus, it is 500,000 people died because of coronavirus, and not that they were probably going to die in the next couple of days, but they also had coronavirus. Not all of them, obviously, but like. It maybe a tenth of them or something like that. Do you think our counting is pretty good there?
I think that the counting for coronavirus deaths is reasonably accurate. And one of the reasons why I can say that is that I've also kept track of a statistic called excess deaths. Mm-hmm. And so we know that actuarially every year we'll have so many deaths because we have this many people in the country who are this many years old, and we have deaths from flu, and we have deaths from this. And we just know on average this is what the death toll every year is. And the excess deaths are deaths that don't fit the actuarial table. And you can have negative excess deaths. If you were having a really good health campaign year, if there's been no major disasters, if you have anything that could cause deaths not happening, then you end up with a excess death surplus, which is really good news. People are still living more than we expected them to. The excess deaths during the coronavirus have matched the trend lines for the counts of the deaths extraordinarily well. And they're higher than the total number. And that covers some of that thing that you're concerned about, where we're getting to deaths that are comorbid with the disease, but not the disease necessarily. So I think in the end, the actual count that we have is accurate. It's at least within a reasonable margin of error to be the deaths caused actually by COVID, because it matches what we're seeing in other statistics.
And as a slight follow-up to that, do you think that we will see, maybe a year from now as a retrospective or anything, do you think we'll see any significant number of excess deaths attributable not to COVID, but to miscellaneous things surrounding COVID? For example, mental, you know, people who home for the holidays, not be able to see their family, suicide rates spike, or people who may be experiencing some chest pains but afraid to go to the hospital, and so they stay home and die of a heart attack when potentially they could have been saved if they'd gone to the hospital, or people putting off various surgeries because they want to try to avoid the hospital, or I guess on the flip side, you might see fewer deaths because there are fewer people on the road commuting to work, fewer automobile deaths. I'm sure the flu deaths this season will probably be pretty low because of all the extra measures taken to try and avoid COVID. So I guess the question is, in either direction, do you anticipate us seeing any kind of surprising or notable shifts in terms of the excess deaths that aren't related to COVID, but are possibly related to things indirectly tied to COVID?
Knock-on effects. And that's a tough question. I don't think I know enough to answer that question accurately. So I'm going to answer it briefly, and then I'm going to pivot to a related question instead, which is one I want to ask you. I don't expect there to be significant percentage changes in expected deaths for other things, even though, yes, we'll obviously have a lot fewer traffic deaths in theory because we have a lot fewer miles driven. But one of the things that I did notice is that because the highways were so open, people were driving higher speeds. And speed is a bigger impact in terms of fatality for traffic incidents than number of miles driven. And so we might actually have seen an increase in traffic fatalities because of that. So no, I don't think that there is a sufficient piece of evidence to indicate that the expected deaths are going to change. The actuarial tables are not going to change much until they adapt to the new normal of coronavirus, whatever that is, in, say, 2 or 3 years. And then we'll have some not-to-be-fluctuating thing, and we'll be waiting for the next spike or reduction. But not just deaths on the one hand, but also births on the other. We talked about the possibility of a baby boom.
Do you think that the 8 weeks or so of relative self-quarantine is going to lead to a population boom?
Dead silence as I ponder that one. I want to say no so badly.
And you mentioned earlier that you had a new child during this time period. Congratulations again, by
Thank
the way.
Thank you.
But was it something that was going to happen? And so I pulled up some statistics.
Mine was conceived before the lockdowns, just so you know.
Okay.
So yes, it was going to happen.
However, the number of births decreased in December, year over year, by more than 7%. So 9 months after the lockdown starts, and instead of seeing a baby boom, we're seeing a baby bust. Not only did we not see a baby boom, we saw the exact opposite.
Yeah.
So we had some discussion about that, and I was saying, yeah, I can see it happening, and I would hope that it wouldn't, because, look, the person that you're locked up with, as I said, is the person that you're already there with, and if you wanted to have a kid, you could have. So it's hopefully then not just, well, you have more time and are bored or anything, but really the fact that there was so much concern and strain on finances and livelihoods that people didn't feel comfortable having kids. And we have so much control these days with prophylaxis and birth control to prevent birth if we don't want to, that even if there was more sex happening, there were fewer kids being born as a result.
So you said you looked up December, right?
That December was the last one that had statistics that I could find. So December, month, year over year, down 7%. January, I don't have yet.
Interesting. So I'm trying to think, because I wonder, and that all makes a lot of sense. I wonder what the marriage rate looks like over that time period. Because I've actually seen in social media and other things a fair number of like people talking about like getting engaged and getting married. Although a lot of times it's like, you know, yeah, we're not going to let COVID stop us from getting married. So, you know, I don't know if I'm just seeing more because people are kind of giving it like the middle finger to COVID or whatever. But I have to imagine that we're probably seeing a drop in marriage rates over this time period, because if you're one of those people where a big wedding is important to you, you can't do that right now. And so why not just put it off until later on? And, you know, some people are old fashioned and believe in not having kids outside of wedlock. And so that could be putting things off. There's probably a non-zero amount of people who are conceived on wedding nights, right? Like that's kind of one of the cliches. So I wonder if that plays any role into it at all. If maybe we're thinking that this too much in terms of like older married couples who are thinking about they should have a second or third, and maybe instead should be thinking about newlyweds and a possible lack of the same number of newlyweds as we would normally have.
That's an excellent question, and I definitely don't have any data on that, so I can't talk.
That's okay. You're not our chief marriage trend correspondent, just the chief coronavirus correspondent.
I promise I'd take us back to the markets eventually, so let's get another financial topic going. Another thing that we talked about at length in the first podcast was price gouging.
We did.
Defend price gouging.
You're the one who defends price gouging. I'm the one who attacks price gouging.
Fine, attack price gouging.
Okay, so price gouging is immoral, obviously.
Okay. So, that turns out not to be all that relevant now, because price gouging is no longer really a thing, which indicates that the market failure that we were talking about that caused price gouging to be a thing was a short-term event, which is exactly what we expected. It was a supply shock. There wasn't enough toilet paper for household consumption because people were used to pooping at work. All the toilet paper was at the offices, not at the houses.
It's funny because it's not something I'd ever really thought about before. Like I'd always wondered like why it was always toilet paper, and I guess that's as good an explanation as any. But
it's at least part of it, and because there was a lot of office space toilet paper that was not being used up. When I visited my office at various points during the lockdown, because I'd pop my when I wasn't working remotely, I'd be in 2-3 times a week. Before I lost my job, the amount of paper products piled up in the cubicles and the areas next to the kitchens and the bathrooms, it was remarkable because the supplies for them kept coming in. So there's rows and rows of paper towels and toilet paper, and it was just sitting there ready for us as soon as we came back. But no, it wasn't the same stuff. So that was at least a part of the supply shock. And the other parts were just people were overbuying because it was a sense of panic. And there's nothing that can compete with that other than just having even more supply. Supply shocks are temporary, and they're removed as the demand goes away and gets eaten up, and as they produce more to meet it. The masks, we caught up on the masks. All of the things that we had a supply shock on, whatever you want to buy now, for the most part, you can get. So in under a year, in most cases in a matter of a month or two, the market failure is corrected, the market corrects itself. We just had that temporary thing, and it does lead us with a question of how do we handle temporary market failures? Because it is a market failure. That's something I wanted to stress still, that this was a failure of the market. But if it's only a temporary failure, isn't that big of a deal? And maybe we should not be so concerned about it. You know, there's a lot of push on, well, you can't price gouge. Fine. But isn't it all going to just be okay in 2 or 3 months? Why is it such a big deal right now? As terms of things that we were talking about back in March, that was one that's no one's talking about at all anymore because it wasn't important.
Well, I'll tell you one thing where I think it could be argued we're still seeing a market failure. So I guess let me preface it with this. I'm not a big fan of the term market failure. I'm not entirely sure what it means, really. I guess it means that some kind of imbalance in supply and demand makes something not available, and so the market's failing. But I guess one area where we're seeing supply not meeting demand is housing. We are seeing, and you look at the numbers, for various reasons, a lot of it seems to be that people can telework more now. And so why spend, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars for a one-bedroom, one-bathroom apartment in New York City when you can live like a king in upstate New York and have a single-family home and still keep your well-paying job? We're seeing a pretty red-hot housing market. I think maybe webcams have finally gone back in stock, but for a while, webcams are completely unavailable. So I think there are still things where the supply has yet to completely catch up with demand. But I guess I would say, yeah, I stand by everything I said earlier on where I think... we're talking about the temporary, for a couple of weeks during the early stages of the pandemic, people couldn't get toilet paper, hand sanitizer, hand soap, whatever it was. We'll use toilet paper. I still think we're better off with letting stores raise their prices so that the people who are most for whom toilet paper is the most desperate need for them is able to get it, rather than the person who first shows up just buys all the toilet paper so that nobody else can get it. I think prices should reflect the supply and demand trade-off, and that not only will higher prices deter people from buying much more than they need so that more people can get toilet paper, it also incentivizes more people to produce toilet paper, because I'm assuming the margins on toilet paper aren't that great at a normal price. But if people are willing to pay two times the normal price for toilet paper because all of a sudden, as you said, people are pooping at home instead of pooping at work, well, then, you know, maybe Kleenex will start producing toilet paper instead of Kleenex instead of tissues, and we'll have more supply covering it. And we saw a lot of that with masks, right? Like, as far as I can tell, there wasn't a ton of price control on masks. And as a result, we saw, Etsy is a company that actually broke out their non-mask sales because they saw such a surge in people producing masks and selling them on Etsy, like, right? Like the website where people kind of do their own handmade products and sell it on there. They had such a surge in people selling masks on there, they had to break out non-mask sales to show that how the rest of the business was performing. So when you allow the markets to work in terms of supply and demand, you will find that supply rises to meet that demand. And I think we saw that more or less, despite the actions of eBay and others, as I talked about before. And yeah, maybe the difference is that the problem was fixed in 1 week instead of two, or 2 weeks instead of one. But I still think that letting prices fluctuate between supply and demand is the way to go. So you tell me why I'm wrong, you commie bastard.
I will do neither of those things. Well, I'll tell you why you're wrong, maybe. prices probably should fluctuate. But when prices fluctuate too much because there is this shock to the system, then especially for goods that are important to general livelihood, not luxury goods. Luxury goods fluctuate all you want. I don't think anyone's going to have too much of an issue. But food prices that shock heavily, or toilet paper, although not a strict necessity, very close to a necessity, when those things fluctuate to the point where you have to pay $20 for a roll of toilet paper, otherwise you're not going to be able to buy a roll of toilet paper at all, then people who don't have that $20 can't get the toilet paper. People who don't have any money, or people who have $5 can't buy a $50 thing of food because that's the price of food now. That is a real problem for society, even if it isn't necessarily, based on what you're saying, a market failure, because the market's pricing it appropriately based on the scarcity, there is still a problem for society. With toilet paper, in March, it was a temporary shock, and I think everyone knew it was going to be a temporary shock for the most part. Maybe not everyone, because I did see plenty of articles of people stuck with thousands of rolls of toilet paper in their garage as they stocked up over much, but for the most part, people were like, look, I just need my toilet paper, and there's not enough for whatever reason, and they get caught up and they're fine, even if it did take a month or two for it to finally settle down. But if that were food, if that had been, you know, food goods, if there was one thing, if it was unit of food, as opposed to the pantheon of food that we have, that could have been a much bigger problem for us. And that didn't happen this time, but that doesn't mean that it won't happen at some point in the future. And that is something to be concerned about, and to spend some time, I think, for you, thinking about what it means to the market philosophies if it means that people are going to starve if they don't have any money, if they have less than all of the money, perhaps, because there's always going to be people who have money and can afford to buy it. But if it's more than the average person has, it's going to be a problem. And it worked out okay here, and I think it will continue to. I'm not really too concerned about it. But when we have those momentary shocks, it gives us a reason to think about it and how we can handle this as a society to make sure that we don't have people hurting because of being on the wrong side of the scale at the wrong time.
Sure. And obviously I agree. Like, if the choice is between should toilet paper be $20 or $1, sure. Like, I'm not saying I want people to have to pay like out the nose for toilet paper because just for the sanctity of the free market or anything like that. I think the real problem is that the question is, should toilet paper be $20 or should you not be able to buy toilet paper at all? Because when you don't allow prices to rise like that, you have the person coming in and being like, I'll take all the toilet paper, and they put it in their garage. And then the second person who shows up says, I was willing to pay $20 for toilet paper, but there is no toilet paper here. And that's the problem.
And this is, we had that discussion last year, and it was just as good last year, but I end up with the same point where, yeah, you're right, unless you don't have $20. Mm-hmm. Because then the decision is the same. Would I rather have a roll of toilet paper or $20? Well, I don't have either one now. And so if I'm in the situation where I need it and I can't have either, then your point of, well, I'd rather be in the position where I could pay $20 and be able to buy a roll of toilet paper than not buy a roll of toilet paper is the same thing for that person. They can't buy the roll of toilet paper regardless.
Sure. But the person who does have $20 can buy it, whereas before they couldn't. So, yeah, someone's always going to get screwed. I mean, listen, like, the market's not perfect. I 100% agree. Someone still's got to be, like, the low-paid janitor who just sits around cleaning up people's shit all day, and that sucks for them, right? Like, someone's got to do that job. And in a situation like this, like, yeah, poor people, as they often do, are going to get screwed, right? Like, you just want to go out and buy your oatmeal for breakfast to feed your family, and all of a sudden the price is tripled because a bunch of people have gone out and stocked up their garage with it. The question is, what's the best solution? And is the solution to be like, well, because some people are going to get screwed, everyone should get screwed? Or let's, try and, I guess, let the people who have a little bit more money than the poor people still get by. And yes, the poor people are going to get screwed no matter what. So, sorry. Unless you have a better solution, like I don't know how we're letting people have toilet paper for cheap without and fixing the problem of people potentially hoarding it.
Well, what happened in this case was something close to that, where there was the occasional time where someone wasn't able to buy any toilet paper at all, and so everyone was kind of left with their butts hanging out. But by and large, it resolved itself in a short period of time. The supply shock ended, and we were back to normal. Everyone has toilet paper again. And there was no real harm done to anyone because it was toilet paper, right? I have enough faith in the market and the production capacity of the country that we can overcome any market shock in fairly short order, as evidenced even by the vaccine. The vaccine was basically infinite demand for something that didn't exist yet, and we overcame it. And got it in a year. Incredible. So my point is, I'm not concerned about the temporary ones too much, and I want to avoid having fluctuations in price that are too extreme in most cases. I'm not saying it shouldn't fluctuate. I'm saying it shouldn't be, it was a dollar yesterday and it's $20 today. That seems like a problem that can cause all kinds of issues for speculation and hedging and panic-driven buying. The solution is don't panic, as I was so fond of saying a year ago. But people don't listen to that. So the next solution has to be something where they're prevented from panicking. And I don't like that one bit. I think that the market solution probably is better, but that's another option. And there are ways that we can address that. But yeah, ultimately, this is a problem where if there is a disjoint in that disruption in the market where there's not enough of a supply to a thing and someone is going to be screwed over, then yeah, it's going to be the poor person. I want to make sure that doesn't happen, though. So what are we going to do to... I've asked you already on a different podcast, solve poverty, Paul. I'm not going to do that right now. But as much as this stimulus is an example of inflation and could exacerbate, if we had had this stimulus where, here's $1,400 from the government, go buy some toilet paper if you can find it, what would the price of toilet paper have been in that situation?
$1,400.
Right? Right, potentially. So it's a real risk to have two forms of inflation going side by side, because that's how you're going to get hyperinflation. So if you have the inflation alongside the market shock, it's really, really risky, I think. And if you're going to have the stimulus inflation, you want to make sure that you've got the supply covered.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned if hand sanitizer was a dollar yesterday and $20 today. And my first thought was, well, you can thank Joe Biden and his like $9 quintillion stimulus bill for inflation, because that's what I would use to describe that. Yeah. I mean, I don't see, and I realize that I was saying this exact thing 12 years ago, whenever during the Great Recession and all the extreme measures the Federal Reserve was taking then. I simply don't see how we don't see a lot of inflation out of this.
So here's a new under-over for you. We can come back to this one in a year. Peg the under-over for inflation for a year from now. What does the inflation look like over the next
As measured by what? Like the official federal government?
CPI.
And what is so... I never realized I'm putting you on the spot, but you're also putting me on the spot here. What exactly is...
it was completely... this is on... I came up with this on... this is not on my
Because the CPI, like, excludes a shit ton of things, right? Like, to the point that it's... a lot of people question about...
There's a couple different measures, so let me...
Like, so if I understand, like, it excludes a lot of... Well, yeah, I'll let you look it up. Inflation. So, what is the... I'm going to think out loud here because I don't really have a good answer here. I feel like...
CPI includes anything bought by consumers, including foreign goods, which is different from the GDP deflator, which does not include foreign goods. And CPI does not include services, but only goods.
Well, here's a question. What was the CPI for 2020? Was there deflation?
1.0%.
So there was inflation in 2020.
There was inflation in 2020. It was 1.0%, which is good because deflation is really bad news as far as economics go.
I feel like deflation in a lockdown environment is okay.
It's expected, but it's not good. Just because it's expected doesn't mean that it's awful. I mean, it would have been really, really bad. From 2019 to 2020, it was only 1.4%, though. So it's not like it went down. It went down from the previous year 40%. Kind of thing, but
so you're making the argument that deflation is always bad.
I have seen deflation wreck economies. I have never seen inflation wreck an economy. Hyperinflation.
The Weimar Republic would like to have a word with you.
So that's hyperinflation. So it has to be extraordinarily extreme inflation before it's really bad. Like you got to be at 10-20% before it's going to have that kind of impact. Whereas 2% deflation will destroy an economy.
I think offline I'll have to ask you for some examples of these 2% deflations wrecking economies. But okay, so the inflation for a year from now, so what we're talking about, March.
So the past 2019 was 1.4%, 2020 was 1%. So that's, you know, you figure your range is going to be there, and you're saying it's going to be higher because we've had a lot of stimulus and the economy is going to start picking up because of the vaccine, and we're going to open things up again, so we're going to get hot, right? So it's going to be probably more than 1%, probably more than 1.4%. How high are you going to go?
Am I saying an over under and you're going to, or a number and you're going to pick the over under?
Yeah, peg it. I'll go over under.
So having absolutely
unless you want me to peg it, and then
having absolutely no idea what a normal quote unquote number is outside of like the two numbers you've quoted for the past 2 years, I am going to say 2%. No, I don't want more information. I don't want to make an informed guess here. I'm going to make a random, uneducated guess, and that is 2%.
All right, so let me get you one more statistic here, which is from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which says that consumer prices increased 2.3% for year ending February 2020. From February 19th to February 2020, the consumer price index for all urban consumers, CPIU, rose 2.3%. So we're going to have to be really precise about what we're looking at here.
Yeah, you got to pick a number or a metric.
We got to pick the right metric to make sure we're staying consistent. 5 days ago, CPI, BLS, I like BLS stuff for the most part. 1 month changes. April was -0.7, so we had some deflation in April. Almost a full percentage point in April after half a percentage point in May, March basically, and then May we recovered to normal.
So wait, you're saying April of what?
April of last year, April of 2020 was really bad. April of 2020 we had deflation.
Is that the most recent number that we have? April of 2020?
No, the most recent month was. February 2021, which had 0.4% inflation, according to CPI.
And is this quarter over quarter, or is this year over year?
No, that's month over month.
I'm too used to investing. Month over month. Okay, so from March of 2020 to April of 2020, it went down almost a full percentage point, is what you're saying.
From March to April, it went down 0.7%. Okay. After having gone down 0.3% in March. And only up 0.1% in February. So February to May, that first quarter of 2020, and a little bit more, we knew that was bad. That's demonstrating that it was, in fact, bad.
Okay. So we're talking about March of 2022?
Yeah, so it'll be basically from February 21 to February 22, because we're going to be a month behind here.
Okay. So we're talking about a year over year then in this case.
A year over year.
Yeah, I'll stick with 2%.
I'm going to go under.
Under. Okay. That's good, because I was going to my first number was going to be higher, so I'll gladly take the over on that. I'll probably be wrong because for some reason inflation never seems to show up. But
which is exactly the point.
I mean, I don't understand how this happens, but somehow, despite the increase in the money supply, inflation never seems to show up. So,
well, here's my explanation for you for right now. We are increasing the money supply. I can't deny that. That is inflationary. I can't deny that. Why isn't it causing inflation? Because there is so much deflation happening elsewhere. Whereas, the inflation coming from those stimulus monies is counteracting the deflation of people not working and producing. So we have lost so many jobs and have people not producing at the high levels that they were before. Kids not going to school, people not buying gas, not going on vacations, not working, literally not working. So that the economy is deflated from that. And I don't see that improving dramatically in the next year enough that the stimulus that has been going in is going to be actually inflationary. It's enough to tread water.
There's a non-zero number of people who have postulated that you've heard of like how history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes or something along those lines. I guess the Spanish flu was, what, 1919? Is that... Am I right about that? Yep. Yeah, so Spanish flu was 1919. And then afterwards, there was a roaring 20s. And lo and behold, not only are we in a year that ends, well, I guess now it's 21, but we're in 2021. So there's the double 20s. And so people have postulated that maybe we're due for, since we had our own little version of the Spanish flu with coronavirus, that we're due for a new roaring 20s as people come out of lockdown and spend all the stimulus money on vacations and new businesses and whatever, like all the experiences, going to movies and flying and cruises that they've been denying themselves. I don't know if I buy that, but I do think that the government and the Federal Reserve have both made it very clear that at the slightest hiccup of the economy, that they're willing to dump nearly limitless amounts of money to solve the problem. And they have no appetite at all for being conservative with the money supply and taking the chance of slowing down this economy. And
there is no austerity happening in the United States of America.
Yeah, and so, again, with having said that I've been wrong about this for well on like 12 years now, maybe even 13. I just don't see how this doesn't eventually end in some sort of nasty inflation and possibly hyperinflation. Because the thing is, once it starts hitting, like, it can accelerate pretty fast.
Yeah. You're well positioned, at least, as a man who is fully invested for an eventual inflation because you own real property, as it were. Stocks are some of the stuff that is going to be inflation protected, and you are a property owner as well. This is also going to be inflation protected. So congratulations on hedging yourself as best you can. But yeah, I don't think, as much as those are good investments to have, I don't expect them to be skyrocketing extraordinarily. I do think we may see some really good years coming forward. There will be certainly a desire to spend more, to do more, and people who have been harmed by the economy trying to get back and recover what they've lost over the next, especially 5 years. But if we're talking about analogs between 1919 and 2020, then remember what happened at the end of those roaring 20s.
The Great Depression.
Yeah. So that no matter which direction you're looking at, you know, hey, we have had a bad time and we have a good time coming. There's always another bad time coming, and there's always another good time coming. So you have to be prepared for both. And yeah, we can say, well, the government's going to protect us as best they can. And, you know, at least they're going to have our backs and financially support us. But you have to be looking out for yourself first and foremost as best you can, which means not counting on that kind of stuff and preparing for the worst. So I think we have turned a corner as far as coronavirus goes. It's been a really interesting year. Glad it went okay for you. Hope it could be better for people than it was for me. Hopefully this next year will not be too bad for anyone else.
Well, I will say, you say that I'm excellently hedged, but I'll tell you one thing. I do not own any bolt cutters. So I think I gotta fix that before I consider myself supremely hedged. Well, here's
the
thing.
What you need, your situation is not so much the bolt cutters, because you're already hedged against these things. What you need are some bolt cutter resistant bolts.
And a couple of shotguns, I guess. Maybe a moat with alligators that shoot lasers from their eyes, or I can't even remember the Austin Powers quote. Is it sharks that shoot lasers from their eyes?
I think it is sharks with lasers for eyes, but here's the thing. I've not seen the movie, so I don't know. Oh,
man. That's surprising. We should fix that. Go check out our best movies of the 90s and 2000s if you haven't.
Yeah, I remember saying something about that movie not being all that great.
Well, tune in for Andrew's terrible takes on movies. But we might have some video game episodes coming up soon. Maybe. Don't want to pull back the curtain too much. Sorry. I'm skipping ahead a little bit. Were we winding down, or did you have more you want to talk about?
I've covered my list. Unless you have something on your list, I think now is as good time to wind down as any. We've been running for an hour and 45 minutes.
Yeah, basically. I feel like once we hit, like, honestly, I feel like once we hit about 3 minutes, people stop listening. So I think they definitely stop listening after an hour and 43 minutes. So seems like as good a place as any to wrap up. So thank you for joining us. And thank you, Andrew, for deciding to rub it in my face how off I was on our bet from a year ago. Because
you had a good peg. You don't have a good peg on the inflation. Although, honestly, it's a good peg on the inflation, too. I could see 1.8% happening. So two is.
So we're definitely betting a Bitcoin on this, right? Thank you for joining me. Check us out at rampantdiscourse.com, at facebook.com/rampantdiscourse. You can talk to us on discord.io/rampantdiscourse. You can check us out on Twitter at rampantdisc, D-I-S-C. And did I forget anything? I think I covered
everything. I had to do that last night, and I think I got everything except Facebook. And I think I got
that's okay. Too. Facebook is the most evil thing on the planet, so nobody uses that anyway. So, all right, can't stop the discourse.